And I hadn't realized it at the time. Now, and one of the threads of my research is literally about purpose. And the psychological definition of what is called construct strength of purpose is that a purpose is something that's bigger than you, something that would take more than a lifetime to complete. And interestingly enough, in my own work, what we've been able to find by mashing up machine learning and big data analysis is the single biggest behavioral correlate of purpose. The thing people do in their daily lives that predicts their strength of purpose the most is making a sacrifice.
Welcome to the Enrichment Project, Path to Purpose, recorded by the mad talent at Solid Gold Podcast. It is a series of unfiltered and insightful conversations with some of the most remarkable purpose-driven human beings who have all achieved, created, inspired, triumphed, or challenged, and we have a great deal to learn from them. It is a quest to uncover and articulate the steps along the way to help you on your own journey of purpose. I am your host, Richard Wright, and I am delighted to have you with me. Thank you for the gift of your time. Let's dive straight in. So I'm going to be completely candid and vulnerable and authentic and tell you, everybody tuned in and listening, that I am more excited than I think I've been for any of my conversations. I'm pinching myself and I can't quite believe who is looking at me from the other side of the world. It is Dr. Vivian Ming. She is a theoretical neuroscientist and artificial intelligence expert, named one of BBC 100 Women in 2017, one of Financial Times LGBT leaders and allies today. But the title I like the most is Professional Mad Scientist. Vivian, welcome to the show.
It is such a pleasure. It may sound like a kind of LinkedIn line, but Professional Mad Scientist is just the single shortest way I could think to describe the work that I do. And I am quite mad and genuinely love science. So mashing those two things up and figuring out how to make a career of it has been one of the great joys of my life.
Fantastic. And we're going to talk about that a lot. What I particularly like about it is in this interview process and all the episodes, coming up with a short, punchy title that gets everything in, mashing it all together to put on a tiny little tile has been a challenge. And you just gifted me. Thank you. So if we can start right at the beginning, you've got one of those stories that is just, wow. You know, in fact, in terms of trying to put questions together and trying to get an idea of what I really wanted to get out of this selfishly for the project, but also just wanting to chat to you about who you are and what you're about, it's kind of, how do I even pick? It really is like that. So let's start with your childhood and what that was like and take it from there.
Yeah, you know, to be the kind of guest that just ignores the question, but I promise that I'm not. My life now is amazing, exceptional. I wish everyone could get to do what I get to do. I've founded now 6 companies. I've been the chief scientist at a couple of others. I spend my time doing philanthropic work. I sit on the boards of companies building cyborgs, which is what I literally went to grad school to learn how to do. It's amazing. I got to build, you know, an AI to treat my son's diabetes. Like, yeah. I get this amazing life. And if you looked at the very earliest moments of my life, one little window, you thought, of course, John Steinbeck wrote a book titled The Pastures of Heaven. It's set in this little valley in California. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the pastures of heaven. My dad was a doctor. My mother was a teacher. We may not have been wealthy on some global sense, but I had the most amazing early life. And not only that, I was supposed to be gifted. I was supposed to win a Nobel Prize. Like, this is something I understood when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what an odd thing to think, you know, you're in second grade and like, oh, I should really be getting, you know, my math homework done because I'm supposed to win a Nobel Prize. and I don't mean this in the sense that my parents were cruel. It was just an expectation.
Yeah.
And so this is where I started, right? This little golden child in the golden state, hidden away in the pastures of heaven. Of course, I had a great life, but it turns out it didn't really work out that way. You know, the more I tried to be that person, the more everything fell apart. The worse I did in school. I mean, everyone knew I was clever, but by the time I reached secondary school, high school, it was just a joke. I was sleeping through my classes. In fact, to give a sense of what a weirdo I am, the most trouble I ever got in school by far was forging a letter from my parents insisting that I stay in an honors program that I had effectively flunked out of. I wanted to sleep through the honors classes. I didn't want to sleep through the regular classes.
Sure.
I was strange. Even back then, I was a pretty strange kid, but I was also unhappy. It's just, you know, when you are supposed to be someone that changes the world, whatever it might be, you're supposed to be this great novelist, you're supposed to be this great scientist, and you are so clearly not, then eventually you learn that lesson that you are a terrible person. You're a failure. You internalize it. Doesn't matter how much love my parents gave me. I understood what a failure I was.
So if I can just stop you there for a second. So I spent a lot of my childhood trying to be the good boy, trying to be the person my parents expected me to be. And I think a lot of us do. It's conditioning. You know, when you do this, oh, good boy, Rich, we love you. We're so proud of you. Please do more of that. And when you do that, well, we don't love you anymore. Go to your room and beat yourself up and get that out of your system and come out so we can love you again. So you become what you need to be to fulfill the expectations, dreams, whatever it is of your parents. So the question I've got for you is that pressure that you put on yourself, or that's some external pressure to be this Nobel Prize winner, to be this super smart, bright, intelligent, genius person, where did that come from?
So this is the thing that perhaps I didn't appreciate as a story. In fact, I didn't really know it, frankly, till I was an adult. A lot of it became deeply internalized. It was me thinking I was a failure because I was supposed to be this person. But the simple truth is, most clearly, it came from my father, who was an amazing person. He's far and away the person that had the most impact on me throughout my life. Much of who I am comes from him. But what I didn't fully understand, you know, I knew that he didn't grow up in, you know, the Bay Area of California and all the advantages that I had. He grew up in Kansas. In fact, as I often said it, like, this is nowhere Kansas. You know, Dorothy has never heard of the town that he's come from. So he, you know, he grew up kind of a farm boy in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, he became this exceptional person just kind of through force of will. He was, when he graduated himself from high school, he was the top of his class for the entire state of Kansas, which, quite frankly, was probably more people back then than it is now. He got scholarships to everywhere in the world, full ride scholarships. But there are two parts of the story, one that I knew and one that I didn't. The one that I knew is that he turned them down. He went to university. He went to the University of Kansas, which I've been to many times in my life. Perfectly good school, but I'm willing to bet to a global audience, you've never heard of the University of Kansas unless you happen to be a big basketball fan. MIT, where he always regretted not going, that you've heard of. So he was filled with these regrets for the person he could have been. They accepted him. But, and, you know, bluntly, it was really my grandparents, wonderful people though they were. What's the point? What's the point of going halfway across the continent to some technical school?
You can go and
what's the point of being the smart kid on the farm?
Yeah.
Go to an agricultural school, learn a trade, go from there. In fact, frankly, for all of its ugliness, he got effectively drafted into the Vietnam War, and that changed the course of his life in large part.
Yeah.
But what I didn't appreciate wasn't that, you know, I always imagined genuinely that my grandfather was, oh, sure, he was from this small town in Kansas, but he was probably the mayor or something. He was an exceptional person. No, my father, until he went off to university, and my grandfather, they were sharecroppers.
Wow.
I genuinely didn't know this, but they didn't even own the land that they were farming. They were effectively the American version of subsistence farmers. My father took himself out of that, then missed the opportunity, as he always sought through the rest of his life, to become someone that mattered. Of course he mattered.
Yeah.
But it was lodged in his head.
Yeah.
And then he had this child that could be that person for him. And again, I'm not saying that he was cruel. He wasn't. He was amazing. But it was, I was supposed to be everything that he wasn't.
I mean, our parents do that because that's what they want for us, and they want the best for us. And they want the best for us through the lenses of their own eyes. So very much, yeah, the sins of the parents and the forefathers, that is what it is. And I guess, you know, what's up to us, I believe that our job as a parent is to become, to create a platform for our children where they can become anything they want and better human beings than we could ever possibly have become. I know how the story ends. I think you've done that extremely successfully well, but it hasn't come without a lot of pain, suffering, mess, ugliness, hardship. So yes, next chapter, here we go.
Well, you know, the thing I think that's most heartbreaking to me with respect to my father is, for all of that missed opportunity, he still went from, you know, harvesting wheat on someone else's farm to becoming a doctor, to raising this amazing family and actually teaching rounds at Stanford Medical School. I mean, for all of his regrets, he had this classic American trajectory to his life.
Yeah.
And I had the exact opposite. I went from everything he gave me to nearly flunking out of secondary school, of high school. Then I get to university purely on test scores. I even back then, I tested really well, even when I didn't try. And then that was it. Without any more, you know, structure to my life, it all fell apart. Within just a couple of years, I'd flunked out. And after flunking out, I ended up homeless. You know, there was nothing. I had nothing to give. I didn't know why I was such a failure. I didn't understand why I couldn't be for them, for me, for anyone else. I couldn't be the person I was supposed to be. So I just gave up. And I don't mean, and I'm so lucky, like there was no secondary cause here. I didn't use drugs. I don't drink. I'm literally scared of anything like that. For a variety of reasons in my life, the idea of losing control of yourself is not something I was interested in being a part of. I literally just crawled into bed and then never left. And pretty soon a car became my bed. It was brutal. I mean, actually, it went from bed to a closet where I'd just go hide and then into my car. It all sounds so pathetic, but
it's real.
You have to understand, I hated myself because I was supposed to help people and I wasn't. And so that's where I found myself. I was born in the early 70s, and now let's take it to 1995. And I'm living in my car. And
I have to ask this question. Sorry. Right?
No, do it.
How does one live in a car? Where do you park? What about bathroom and food and all that stuff?
Yeah, so I had a large car. If anyone can remember this, it was called a Suburban. So it was this giant monstrosity of a car, but very, very old.
Yeah.
And so I'd simply set up the back with some cushions that I'd found somewhere, and I just curl up out there. And it meant, you know, find a different parking lot each night. And find places that had open bathrooms that you could go to. I am fairly clever. You know, during this period, no one knew. I didn't have a lot of relationships. Oh. In fact, that year, 95, I can't tell you how lonely it is to spend a year without people, surrounded by them, but completely cut off and disconnected. Changes how you look at issues like homelessness to have not just experienced it intellectually, but to have thought, where is my next meal coming from? Yeah. And why doesn't anyone else understand how lonely I am? Despite the fact that, of course, it was all self-inflicted.
But when you get that low, and when the level of self-loathing is that intense, that's got to be consuming. And so obviously, I mean, you've answered some of it, but I kind of think, well, where were your parents, you know? And, but I guess you can't admit that to your parents because now you're spectacularly failing in every single avenue and that's just going to make it worse, right?
I am supposed to be this amazing person. Mm. I'd managed to trick them into thinking that I graduated from university. I had, and so they thought, you know, it's the Bay Area. I was actually in Palo Alto, where Stanford is located. So this is one of the wealthiest places in the world. And here I am living in my car. But it turns out it makes it a pretty easy place, right? If you've got the right color skin and a little education, you can really play that ruse up and no one calls you on it. Mm. So, you know, when I say I was living on the streets, be honest, I was not passed out. I had certainly mental health issues. I mean, depression was huge. In fact, at one point I saw, this was actually a couple of years later, but I went and saw someone who was a neurologist and a psychotherapist. And after a few sessions, she said, listen, there's a lot of things wrong with you. And I don't know if I can help with any of them, which I don't think people are supposed to say to their patients. No, that's really not.
You came here with one problem.
Another feedback.
You came here with one problem, but you know, I can identify about 10. So you know, where would you like to start? Should we pick one? Wow. Okay, that doesn't help.
Yeah.
But you're also smart. Yeah. And I get that. So when you go to psychotherapy, you also have a clever way of being able to tell them what you think they want to hear. Yes?
It's one of the actual paradoxes of things like psychotherapy. And for anyone who doesn't know this, I'm saying this now. We're jumping way ahead in the story,
but I'm
a fancy smancy neuroscientist. And so I'm not pulling this out of my hat. But one of the paradoxes of psychotherapy and all of it, cognitive behavioral therapy and a variety of techniques that are used today, is they are used by the very people they will help the least. And for a variety of reasons, one of which is the simple truth that the smarter you are, the better of a liar you are. Now, those two things don't track perfectly together.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, as a variety of cognitive factors, if you don't mind me being nerdy here, increase in an individual, including creativity itself, your ability not only to lie to others, but to yourself.
I was just about to say, must be
and,
yourself.
And then how could a therapist actually help you?
Yeah.
You know, you can put up whatever story and whatever front you want. So back then in 1995, most of my family knew that there was a problem. Mm. My whole life, my family knew I was unhappy because I was pretty transparently unhappy and quiet and isolated. But they didn't really know why. And so I created a story that was the one they wanted to hear. I graduated and I was building this company. Crazy. It was actually a real thing, a film company. I mean, out of nowhere. But I'm a total science fiction fan. So when we had the chance, this person that I'd known earlier in my life asked me to do a science fiction movie. I thought, neither you nor I know anything about film. Anything about anything, frankly. I just flunked out of university. I realize you don't know it, but that's where I was. And you want me to do a science fiction film? But then we were good storytellers. We got this famous novelist, David Brin, to agree to give us access to some of his short stories to make. And it was so exciting. And it was like my last hurrah. This was it. I was going to go all in on this from my car and try and build something out of this.
Yeah.
This was essentially in like 94. That failed. Didn't go anywhere. And actually, I got my partner sent me a script. He was supposed to do the creative work and I was going to do the business because neither of us knew anything. So who the hell cared anyways? And he sent me his first treatment of this screenplay. And it was the single worst thing I had ever read in my life. If you could imagine reading a book, or in this case, a screenplay, and realizing when you got to the end, you didn't just reach the end of the screenplay. You'd reached the end of the movie, the idea of the movie, the idea of the company, and the idea that your life was rescuable. That was how bad it was.
Wow.
So instead, I got a calendar for 1995, and I started crossing off days till the end of the year, because I figured I could keep up the ruse for one more year and then it would all come out. And before I reached the end of the year, that would be it. It's America, so I get a gun and I would kill myself. So that was my 1995, was living in my car, having failed at that last chance, waiting for, I don't know if it was the courage or the misery to be high enough, or just simply to be found out. And just, you know, waiting in that car the whole year with that gun, waiting for the night. And essentially, it ended up being sometime around my birthday. You know, one of the things about chronic depression is it really does bad things to your memory. So it's often hard for me to remember the specifics. But sometime that fall, close around my birthday, I had a night where I got that gun out and that was going to be it. And, you know, it wasn't a cry for help. I would have been thrilled to have figured out something that made my life work. But instead, it was just, I was tired of being so lonely and hating myself so much. And this was the way out. And maybe ironically, given the source that we've sort of talked through here, the thing that really pulled me out of that, or at least got me to make the effort, was I didn't want to do this to my parents. You know, they were the only people that were still a part of my life. Everyone else had given up and they were still there. And I just didn't want to, but that wasn't good enough by itself. I needed, if not a reason, just a way to be alive, a rule. How about, I'm a hard numbers person. Even back then, I needed a system to make decisions, because clearly making decisions for myself, making decisions for my parents, for anyone else's expectation of who I should be, that had failed as miserably as it could possibly have failed. So I had this gun and this very long night, and this will sound like a line. I mean, it literally is, because it's a line that came from my father. He'd always said, live a life of substance. And I thought, well, God, what does that mean to me? I know what it means to him, but what does it mean to me? And I don't mean this as a some sort of weird self-congratulatory pat on the back, what a good person I am, but rather I just came up with a rule that worked. It felt like it was something that was achievable, which is live a life that makes other people's lives better. But it also required the acceptance of two truths, which turned out not to be true. Just so everyone knows. But at the time, I absolutely thought that they were. One is that I would never be happy. That was just it. It wasn't about me.
So you reconciled.
And it wasn't about my happiness.
So it was about you. You reconciled that if I can live a life of making other people's lives better, it doesn't matter if I'm horribly unhappy.
This may seem strange. I'm going to dig deep here, but the end of the novel Strangers, so the Camus, it ends with this very strange scene. I mean, the whole thing's crazy, and why should I find a role model in a clearly psychotic character? But at the very end, he's reconciled how passive he's been through his whole life with this idea that the whole world thinks that he's a terrible person, and therefore he should just lean into it, and he should celebrate their cries of hate. I turned it completely around. I thought, I am a terrible person, but that's not what the world wants me to be. So forget what I want. And in a sunny sense, forget what they want also. Just be someone that makes a difference. And you will never be happy, but that's not the point. This is the only way you're going to be alive. So that was the decision. So I put the gun away and I made it through that night. And then I confessed to my parents. I mean, what's the first step in... live a life that makes other people's lives better if you've dug such a deep hole that you have nothing to offer anyone, you can't even feed yourself, is to at least confess to them what you've done, which I have to say, I don't think I've ever felt as sick to my stomach as telling them the truth after that day. God, it was brutal. But that was step one. And then again, it's not about me. So set aside the vision that I at least imagined I'd sort of curated with everyone around me, and got a job just managing a little, you know, corner market store, convenience store. And you know, there was very much a time in my life when I thought, God, like this is it. I'm going to go through the rest of my life with this very modest goal. In fact, my dream was I'll get a job at a bookstore and I'll spend my days there and I'll get to read books and science fiction and fantasy, which I loved so much and still do. And that was my dream at that point, was that modest goal of actually being able to pay my own rent and feed myself. Yeah, so that's where I was when we reached the new year of 1995, was this, what admittedly was a catharsis, but I mean, the course of my life was the exact opposite of my father's. I started from all of this wonder and privilege, and it squandered it all. And effectively 20 years later, 25 roughly, I had nothing. I did still have my parents. That's a huge thing that many people, homeless, don't have. I had my parents. And while I got a lot of problems, my challenges, my psychological challenges, I don't count amongst them, you know, true pathologies that sort of barred me from life with everyone else. So I had, you know, me and what I could give as a person. And the interesting thing is, you feel like I'm reaching the end of a story, but now I'm just launching into phase two. And let's be clear, there's even another story after this. So that was the end of everything getting worse. Okay. And here is the truly bizarre story that we're about to launch into, which is everything getting better except inside me.
You've made it this far, probably because the topic resonated with you. If you're wondering what the show is all about, listen to the trailer at the start of the season and find out how this show is going to help you along your own path to purpose. You've stumbled on a project that is all about purpose. Find out why the guests are all so vastly different, but yet all have so much in common. Hop on board this journey with me, follow the Enrichment Project so that you don't miss out on a single episode, and share it with, well, everyone. We are all looking for more meaning in our lives. If the show speaks to your identity or the identity of your brand, consider sponsoring a season. Let's make the circle bigger. Back to the episode, and thanks for listening. So I want to ask one thing before we launch into the next bit. And that is, I'm going to guess, yeah, but... So I grew up in a home, very conservative. My mom was a teacher, my dad, electrical engineer. And again, it's very, very similar to you, is my dad, really, really humble, Salvation Army, moved around the country, no money, didn't make it through university. And their dream obviously was for their son to do better. And I did spectacularly badly. I really messed that one up. That part of it, and it's been my biggest gripe in life, right, is my parents don't get me. They just don't understand me. And if they could just understand me, you know, and it was that emotional gap. And for a lot of when I was a kid, it was like, I used to tell people that I don't belong in this family. I think my parents found me at a rubbish bin and you know, rubbish tip, and they kind of adopted me because I just don't fit in. I'm not part of these people. And there was so much of that journey was they just don't get me. They don't understand. I'm so different. And what I want to ask is, so you've come back now, right? And you've confessed. How much deep understanding did your folks have for what you'd been through, what you were battling from a psychological point of view? Was there that, or was it just a delighted to have you back? Thanks for being honest. Glad you wanted you better.
You know, what's interesting is my mother and father are very different people themselves. Mm. By this point, they were separated. Okay. You know, my mother had many challenges in her life as well. Mm. In fact, so much so that I'm planning to write a book just about where I came from, which is to say, not about me, but about both my father's life and my mother's life and all of the stories reaching back. People came from all, we can trace it back to all over Europe. People came together for this one brief moment in this one place in America. And I came out of that. Yeah. And understanding all those challenges and the successes and the failures is worthwhile. But what they had made in my mother, when I confessed to her, was someone that wanted safety. You know, she wanted the reliable. She wanted me to become a doctor like my father, because that was reliable and respectable. And it's wonderful. I'd always kind of generically assumed that that's probably what I would be. My father, though, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but he built me. If you want to know who I am today, go back to Sunday nights with my dad. Yeah. And the rest of my family has gone to sleep and I'm supposed to be in bed also, this little kid. Instead, I'd sneak out and my father would be puffing away on his pipe, watching the television, except he wasn't really. He was reading a book and reading the newspaper and watching the public broadcasting, PBS in America, which largely runs a bunch of shows from the BBC.
Okay.
And so every Sunday night for me would be sneaking out and doing the wrong thing and not getting punished for it, followed with watching all of these science shows, some from the US, some from the BBC. So Nature and Cosmos and Connections and all of these shows about science and the wonder of the world. And then it would transition into the BBC comedies. So Monty Python and, Blackadder and all of these other shows. And then from there, it would translate into BBC sci-fi, most obviously Doctor Who. So if you want to know who I am, my sense of humor, my job, and why I call myself a mad scientist, understand, like, if anyone's ever asked you, what superpower would you have? Mm-hmm. And you run through that, I put them together and I realize, oh shit, I'm Doctor Who. Like that's, I want to be this genius that flies through the world and saves people with nothing but the strength of my mind. And gosh, it'd be nice also if I never died. So like those nights and everything he role modeled to me was what made me who I wanted to be.
Yeah.
I just could never live up to trying to be someone else's vision of that person. Mm-hmm. So when I came out to him, like he only wanted the best.
Yeah.
And he, unlike my mother, you know, he was torn. Yeah, he wanted me to be a doctor and he wanted me to follow, but he also wanted me to be the person that he wasn't. He wanted me to be this grand person whose name was written in history and who would change the world. And that was, you know, it was actually, it became a challenge, right? To know, and maybe it was not just him, but something about growing up with a certain degree of privilege in California in that moment in time and feeling like your life is only worthwhile if you write the great American novel, if you win a Nobel Prize, if you become, you know, the next titan of industry. Otherwise, you haven't found you. Kind of a weird take on the world. But, you know, I think there's a reason Silicon Valley came into existence at the very time and place where I was growing up with these same sort of pressures, which is you have to be this amazing person that completely transforms the world. Otherwise, you're worthless.
Who are you?
So, when I came back, like they were immediately embracing. My dad got me that job. A friend of his set up that thing. He didn't think though that I'd stay there. This is just to get me started.
Back in your feet.
And so I did that. And then just dumb luck, a friend of mine had been, this will really sound like it's out of nowhere, but he'd been managing an abalone farm. And he had kind of burned out on the process. And so he asked me if I'd take over. Yeah. So here I am with no degree, no qualifications, nothing whatsoever, in charge of this company. And yeah, I was kind of a caretaker because it was like Lord of the Flies, but in Spanish with duct tape, keeping this rickety ship afloat. But it was amazing also. I lived on this little promontory near a town called Santa Cruz on the California coast. Mm-hmm. I lived on site with a giant bay window that looked out on the Pacific Ocean. During migration season, I could watch the humpback whales with their calves migrating literally down off a 70-foot cliff that was right outside my window.
Sure.
Note at the same time, the building I was in, my home, was actually a collapsed laboratory. This place had gotten a ton of money pumped into it. It had never really turned out. And so that's why a completely untried, tested person was in charge of it.
Yeah.
But I thought, all right, I'll just clean up this thing. Only half of the building is collapsed. I'll live in the other half and I'll be out here. And for 2 years, I had to keep, you know, $6 million worth of giant marine snails alive. It was just me and my dog. And you can't win. Like, there was no end part to that company that was going to be positive. The only reason I was there was to keep it alive long enough to be carved up for parts.
Sure.
And that was a great lesson. Like, if my whole life had taught me that I was, anything I did was worthless unless it was perfect, unless it was superlative, this couldn't be. There was nothing I could do. It was just 2 years of a life lesson about control what you can. And that was really immensely valuable. And and at the end of that, I had saved up enough money to go back to university.
Fabulous.
Yeah. So that was, you know, this 5 years and, you know, I crawled back out of that hole. I got back. All I'd done, I was now approaching 30 years of age. And all I'd managed to do was get back to where I'd started, which is a tough way to look over 30 years of your life.
Yeah.
But I did. And this is the only part of my story for which I can't give you a clear answer why I thought I could do this. But I decided I really didn't want to go to university. I wanted to go to grad school. So university was just a barrier between that and me. So I thought, I'll do it in 1 year. I'll go back to the same university that I had flunked out of, that I'd failed miserably at.
Yeah.
And I will do an entire degree in a single year. And I'm a total snob. So, you know, a technical degree. Uh-huh. So I figured out which ones I could do in a single year. And it was math, economics, or cognitive neuroscience. And I thought, math, what am I ever going to do with that? So little did I know how the rest of my life would go.
Yeah.
But I literally flipped a coin between economics and neuroscience. It came up heads. So I studied brains. Literally, it came up heads. So I know a lot of people would love stories to always have this infusion of meaning. But sometimes you toss a coin because all I knew that I needed to do was live a life that makes other people's lives better. Mm. I felt that I could do that with either one of those skill sets. And so I just let chance choose.
Sure. It's amazing how life is, it's all about circles. It's coming back at the same point and knowing something that you didn't know before and then going back around and coming to, and that's really what it is, you know, and remarkable just how each time we do that, we just have something, a different slant on things, a different angle, a different lens, and we're able to see so clearly. In fact, I often say to people that purpose is the thing that you find when you look backwards and you look over your shoulder and you start to put the pieces together, you know, and you understand them. And there's so many pieces that you're putting together that I can't wait to get it to the end and come back.
Absolutely.
Come back through.
I mean, believe it or not, if you're watching or listening to this, there's a destination. We're not just going to, and today I'm sitting here in front of a camera. No, there's an actual purpose to this conversation.
Absolutely.
But, you know, at this point, though, you know, I'd had this insane idea of doing seven courses. A quarter was a quarterly system at this particular university, and seven courses, two research projects, even though I was, again, walking in one single year. And here was the crazy part.
Yeah.
I did perfect in every class.
Perfect.
I'd gone from the kid that barely scraped through high school, flunked out of this university, to doing as well as anyone's ever done.
Wow.
Perfect grades in completing this in a single year. And but here's the other thing, is only programming course I've ever taken in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I've done a lot of programming, but the only actual formal course was a requirement for this program. And after I finished it, the professor invited me in. This is my first quarterback at university. Invites me in to his office, and he says, listen, this is an interesting guy. His eyes are always bloodshot because he's just stoned out of his head all the time. He's got pizza stains all over his shirt. He was one of my favorite professors ever. He would actually send me to the library to get research papers for him because they wouldn't believe that he was a professor. But he said, would you be a teaching assistant for me next year? But by the way, you got a perfect score in the class. Would you be a teaching assistant for me next year? But I hope you don't mind, but I've recommended you for being a research assistant at this place called the Machine Perception Lab. So this was my introduction to artificial intelligence. Sure. Was again, total chance. I didn't choose it. It was just this professor took a shine to me and said, hey, there's this project going on where they're trying to do real-time lie detection sponsored by the CIA off of cameras, analyzing faces. Yeah. And I thought you might be interested in working on it. Okay. Here's the, well, share the stories about the CIA. It's always a little morally gray, and that's even inside the States. But here's the thing, though, when it comes to purpose, in the moment, that felt kind of good. But literally, by the time I was walking away from that office, I felt as low as I've ever felt in my whole life. Mm. And why, you know, at the time, what was kind of probably going through my head was something like, well, you didn't win a Nobel Prize for your introduction to programming course. But so I could not take any satisfaction from doing this truly exceptional thing. So this is the thing about this phase of my life is externally, everything got better. I pulled myself out of that hole. I managed to feed myself and pay my rent. I got back to university and did just astonishingly well. I had no expectation that this would be the outcome. And I still hated myself. I felt terrible. There was only one difference. There was the only reason I didn't go hide under my bed and give up was that it wasn't about me. And it wasn't about whether I was happy. And that sucked and it was hard. But I had understood that that was true. I had prepared myself for it and I kept moving forward. And I took another batch of courses and got a bunch of more perfect scores. And that project with machine learning was like, whatever you think of the CIA, the fact that my undergraduate research thesis was a system that could recognize a smile, like this fundamentally human seeming thing, being able to see if someone was happy or sad. Turns out it's still very hard to do, but to make some of the initial progress on that, like I thought I was going to be sticking wires into cat brains for the rest of my career, you know, that neuroscientist. And instead, I had discovered this other world where we were studying the brain. We were studying how people perceive faces, for example, but using artificial intelligence to do it, machine learning. And that was addictive. And the fact that I hated myself, I had an amazing start to a new career. I was still terribly lonely and I hated myself. But hey, one thing was better. Keep moving forward.
Okay. And then?
Then these stories should be easier. So it's worth interjecting here that for most of my adult life, starting from late teens, I had all sorts of challenges. I had eating disorders. I had terrible insomnia. I mentioned going to see that neurologist, and it was actually the insomnia that was scary enough that my parents even noticed it. Like, I wanted to fall asleep, but I couldn't. And many listeners might really understand this and experience themselves where there's just voices, not other voices, not a hallucination, but, you know, your own voice. And it's in your head all the time, every bad thing, every hateful thing. The way I would fall asleep was I would imagine people doing terrible things to me. That was comforting because, of course, I felt I deserved it. So I imagine getting beaten. I'd imagine being set on fire. I'd imagine getting drowned just as my way of, that's right, I'm terrible. This is what I deserve. I fooled everyone. This is how I could fall asleep, but I'd still fall asleep. I'd already be watching the sun come up. It was hard, needless to say, but my life gets better. Myself gets worse.
So I wonder if, I mean, that's self-flagellation, let's be honest. And it's, I wonder which is worse, that the physical self-flagellation or that stuff. And I can only imagine that stuff actually that people can't see and imagine.
Yeah, you know, it accumulates. It's obviously, again, I guess I could get very nerdy and talk about this from a brain state perspective, but obviously in many ways, it's doing something similar. Yeah. You know, you're trying to evoke various things like endogenous opioid release. You're trying to quiet down these parts of your medial frontal lobes and your amygdala and everything else that's screaming at you.
Yeah.
that's telling you something bad is happening or is already happening, and you're the cause of it. And it becomes this release. Behaviorally, it certainly feels like a release.
Yeah.
But really, you know, you're kind of doing this little transient brain surgery on yourself again and again and again. And the problem is that as it works, like so many other addictions, it becomes something you have to do harder and harder and harder to get that same effect.
What's quite remarkable, though, is so we become what we think.
Yeah.
Right? It's the law of attraction, and whatever we think, we're going to get more of. So now you're thinking this cognitively, and you are rehearsing the same thing over and over again, getting harder and harder and harder on yourself. How do you not become that, but somehow do the mental gymnastics to become the person that makes other people better?
Well, again, everyone knew I was unhappy.
Yeah.
Everyone could see that I was angry, maybe not so much with any particular person, but just angry and unhappy and lonely. Oh my goodness. I can't watch things about loneliness anymore. It's just, it's too hard. Everyone has their weaknesses. That's my weak point. Anything about loneliness. I literally just even imagining it can get me weepy. But nonetheless, everything is on the surface getting better.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I have this tension between what's going on internally and on the surface. I got to go to whatever grad school I wanted. I went around interviewing at grad schools and literally, you know, I'd say, what do you want to study, to a fellow prospective student? They'd say, well, you know, there's this protein cascade in yeast. And I'd be like, wait, this is a neuroscience program. If anyone's wondering, to a molecular neuroscientist, we're all approximately yeast. It's the neuroscience equivalent of the spherical cow for physicists.
Okay.
And they'd ask me what I want to study, and I'd say cyborgs. And they literally scoot away from me for fear that my crazy would rub off and they get infected with it and wouldn't get in. But it turned out, you know, when you got perfect scores on your standardized tests and perfect grades, and you say, I want to build cyborgs. And it turns out people are already starting to work on what is in fact called neuroprosthetics.
Yeah.
Suddenly people do want to work with you.
Sure.
And so I had my choice of all these places, including MIT, that my father didn't go to years before. I'm a little proud that we have now three times across our two lives, steered away from MIT. Well, let's call it a point of pride at this point. Not that it's a terrible place, but how many families have that history of saying no? But I got to go and study wherever I wanted to. Went to Carnegie Mellon and Stanford and then Berkeley. It was amazing, and I still hated myself.
At what point are we going to tell people what your name was at that point in time?
So here, let me complete the story. And
thank
it's
going
to tie a whole bunch of things together.
Right.
I know I'm dragging it out here, but when I get to grad school, I meet this amazing person named Norma. And the first moment I saw her, she was so cool. In fact, at our wedding, I'm not a singer. So everyone was stunned when I sang some songs.
Oh, wow.
And the two that I sang as part of my vows was I've Just Seen a Face by the Beatles. It's a kind of a deep cut, so you might have to track it down.
Yeah.
But I've Just Seen a Face, and it's about the moment I first saw her.
Yes.
Which I still remember.
Yeah.
And the other was Love Walks In, an old Gershwin ballad. And
sorry, I can't believe that one of them wasn't No More Lonely Nights.
I have to stay away from the power pop ballads. But yes, you're right. I could have gone there because, and we're going to get back to that. But so I had this person, right? I had this amazing career.
Yes.
As a grad student, professors are listening to what I have to say. I get papers published in Nature and in leading machine learning conferences. It was astonishing and nothing like I'd ever experienced before. And then this person fell in love with me. I mean, what incredibly bad taste, but whatever. That's her problem, not mine.
Exactly.
So now I've got this amazing career on its way to a professorship at some amazing professional university. I've got someone that I love who loves me back. It is amazing. I still hated myself, but it's not about me. And it's not about my happiness. And actually, she makes me happy. I don't make me happy, but she does. So I actually, at that point, was ready to just give in and be done.
Yeah.
So here's the final part of at least this story. It's 2005.
Yeah.
Literally my birthday, October 19th, near the very end of the day, probably just about 10 years to the day from the night with the gun. And for no reason whatsoever, I turned to my then fiance and I said, "You want to know my deep, dark secret?" I said, "I wish I was a woman." "Well, good night." And I rolled over to go back to bed. Literally, it came out of nowhere. I didn't, in fact, intend anything from this. Yeah. I felt so open and happy in that moment. I just wanted to share it with her. And yes, if you haven't picked up on the hints so far, I was born a little white boy in California. And all this amazing life that I had that I squandered was as him. And it was not that if somehow I'd been born a girl instead of a boy, that all of my problems would have magically disappeared. In fact, there's a common saying in gender transition that the only thing gender transition changes is your gender. If you've got some other problem,
not going to change that.
That's still going to be there. Yeah. So it was. You know, it was always in the back of my head that part of the reason I was so unhappy was that I didn't want to be me. I was a very good athlete.
Yeah.
And I hated, for example, playing, you know, American football. In fact, literally, my father forced me to play football 1 year. It was a Hail Mary on their part. They sent me to this fancy private high school.
Yeah.
None of my siblings got to go. It was just an attempt to rescue my life. Obviously, it didn't work out, but one of the requirements was I had to play football because he didn't trust all of those, you know, rich, hoity-toity kids.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. As I said, but never to him, it was out on the football field that I realized I was playing for the wrong team. That it was just misery. And of course, you know, I was what, 13, 12, actually.
So
I didn't go through gender transition until I was 35. So that was part of what I hated about myself.
Yeah, that's a lot of time to have to live with that. So the earliest feeling that you identified with a different body than the one that you found yourself in was 12, 13 years of age. But the first time you expressed it.
I mean, before then, I knew I was different.
Yeah.
Right? I knew that, well, of course, the way I thought about it was, why are all the other boys weird? Why are all the other boys obsessed with sex jokes that, quite frankly, none of us were old enough to truly appreciate anyways? Yeah. Okay, farts are funny, but yeah, most of the boy things just never made sense to me. And again, I was a better athlete than all of them.
Yeah.
And yet the obsession with sports, all of that, none of it resonated. It wasn't until I was 12 and on that football field that I realized – shit, it's not them, it's me.
Did you mention to another human being ever? Never.
You know, interestingly, I never mentioned it to anyone before my wife in that moment.
Yeah.
But to give you a sense of, you know, did my parents, you would ask, did they truly understand me?
Yeah.
My father edged around it once. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, he went with a much more standard story.
Right.
He said one day, "You do like girls, don't you?" Like, he knew I was unhappy.
Yeah.
He knew I was unusual. And unfortunately, he asked the question to which I could respond, "Well, yes, I do. Yeah. I am married to one today."
Yeah.
But it wasn't the actual question. If he'd asked me straight up the other question,
yes,
I don't know what I would have said.
What was your answer?
But no one. So my mother, when I finally came out, my wife and I stayed up all night talking, fiance at the time, but obviously she did not bail out when she had the chance. A poor decision on her part.
Yeah. So I don't think so, but that's what I want to say is, how did Norma, I mean, wow, that is earth shattering.
Her response to her fiance turning to her and saying, "You know what I wish I was a woman," was to say, "Tell me more."
Oh.
So she had been a high school teacher and before that a counselor. She'd been trained on what do you do when someone drops a bomb in your classroom. And she totally switched into counselor mode.
Yeah.
But we stayed up talking and like, boy, that moment, which truly was not like, I need to change. It was just, I just wanted you to understand. Yeah. Obviously, that changed so much about my life. But here is the thing.
Yes.
The next night, we went to bed and my head hit the pillow and I immediately fell asleep. Now, if you remember, I said it had my entire adult life, like at this point, 20 some odd years of my life. Brutal insomnia. It was getting worse and worse and worse. I'm willing to bet, though, I can't remember that the night before I came out, I probably watched the sun come up, and I was probably miserable and bleary, but I couldn't. My head hit the pillow. I have not had a single night of insomnia since then. It is the closest thing to magic I have ever experienced in my entire life. It disappeared overnight.
Yeah.
The eating disorders that had challenged me through my life, I continued to struggle with things, but it was a total transformation. Just being able to be honest and open and suddenly be the person you want to be. Then, of course, I didn't appreciate what that would mean. Like, does this really mean I get to go through transition, everything? But here is the deal. We actually got interviewed for Oprah. Not her television show, but she has a magazine. And Norma got asked point blank, like, why did you stay together? You know, I get that you're close, but you agreed to marry a man. And look at this weirdo next to you. That isn't what they said, but you get the picture. I am pretty weird. So, and Norma said, quite frankly, the most romantic thing I've ever heard anyone say, and it was said about me. She said, the person that I loved was unhappy, and I knew it. And now she's happy, and I love her even more. And like, so that was her response. She actually had fears and challenges, and she kept them to herself. For me, she was a rock. We planned out a transition plan, which wasn't just transition.
Yeah.
It was my gender transition, our completing our dissertations, moving across the country, getting married, starting our family, which people are probably now realizing requires a little bit of planning if you have a family like ours.
I'm wondering.
Starting our new jobs, like everything about our lives was about to transform overnight.
That's massive.
And she was a rock. I never got doubts from her. I only got support. She did have doubts. She got support from her sisters who were supportive. And here, you know, is the deal. It turns out I was wrong.
Yeah.
I could be happy. I just couldn't make choices simply to be happy. The way I look at the lesson that I learned of those 10 years, those middle 10 years, it truly isn't about me and my happiness. But that doesn't mean that I could never be happy. It just means that's not how I should judge my life. The happiness, I guess I'm not a very spiritual person. I'm not a religious person. But let me use the metaphor that the happiness is the gift from leading your life the right way. I think even today, if I tried to live my life to be happy or to be wealthy, it would all go away. All of this amazing things I have today, I have them because it's not about me. So that was the launch of that moment. Like the insomnia goes away. I can actually make myself happy. Of course, life still has its challenges in a variety of ways. But suddenly I got to be the person I wanted to be, which turns out isn't even just simply a professor at some elite university. I wanted to invent things that would save people's lives. I wanted to be a professor and build companies. I wanted to be a crazy mad scientist. And so along with being able to be a woman, I created that life too. And I guess the one thing, the true thing that my father gave me, the one thing I could live up to is this idea that in fact, I could do anything. It's not that I believe that it'd be easy, but deeply ingrained in my head is this completely crazed notion that if I put myself to anything, I could accomplish anything. And, you know, being able to completely change yourself, being able to transform what it means to be an academic or an entrepreneur and do it in a completely different way than anyone ever done it before should be terrifying. It should be, you know, the fears should dominate, but it's not about me. And it's not about whether I'm happy. This is simply my path to leading a life that makes other people's lives better. And I hadn't realized it at the time. Now, and one of the threads of my research is literally about purpose. And the psychological definition of what is called construct strength of purpose is that a purpose is something that's bigger than you, something that would take more than a lifetime to complete. And interestingly enough, in my own work, what we've been able to find by mashing up machine learning and big data analysis is the single biggest behavioral correlate of purpose, the thing people do in their daily lives that predicts their strength of purpose the most, is making a sacrifice. Literally doing a thing for which you will never receive a direct benefit. The more people do that in their lives, the stronger the sense of purpose they have. And here's the punchline of all of my research, the better life they end up with. And to realize, and I'm happy to go into more of that, but to realize, well, that's just what my whole miserable, messy life was about. I didn't realize it in 1995 with the gun in the night, that saying it's not about me and I'm just going to have this rule of a life that makes other people's lives better was kind of like the origins of developing a sense of purpose. It was just, frankly, a bit of dumb luck mashed up with not wanting to be dead. And what an astonishing good fortune I had in being to have that moment. I just wish I didn't have to go through all of that. I guess I see my career today as how do I spare people having to go through the crucible just to be who they truly are?
So can we? I look at my life and people often say to me, Rich, if you didn't have to go through 4 years of 3 different brain cancers to learn what you've learned to become the person that you are now, which would you choose, to be the person you were before then, or to have gone through what you've gone through, be who you are now? And it's an impossible question when you're on the other side. But I don't think any of us would become. So a couple of things along this journey, and there's so much I want to say or ask. But so I think one of the biggest things for me is that journey of unbecoming. It's only when you can unbecome, when you can go and go to the deep dark places and go and find that pain and the moments that created who you thought you were. And go back there and do the work, do the hard work. And very few people do. But I think it's only then that you really can start to uncover who you are, which sets you on this path, right? So in my head, it's the same as you. How do I help people? And that's the whole reason for this project, is how do I help people to get to that place without having to go through what you did and me? And then the other part of that is, purpose is about giving a damn. That's what I've realized. And you've said that. And those three, give a damn, three words are your very eloquent quote. Purpose is not purpose unless it's a service of a greater human-centered goal that's important and difficult to achieve. But what purpose isn't for me is this big idea of this thing I have, this thing I've got to target and I've got to achieve that's on the outside of me, because it can't be that, because that's when we're trying to become, it's in the little things we do. And then maybe that's the sacrifices. So it's that random act of kindness. It's the act of gratitude. It's giving a damn about other people or making a difference in other people's lives. The things that make us feel like we have a meaning. And then bring happiness and joy. And which comes first, the happiness and joy or the giving, the service? So I have so many questions around that. Maybe you want to go there for me.
And so many places, yeah, that we could go with it, and the technical definitions and the life stories and all of it. So I guess one of the lessons of my life, as someone, for example, that's done a lot of work in education, founded a couple of companies in the space. My wife runs research for the San Francisco school system. So my life is immersed in it. Obviously, I have two young kids as well. Maybe not obviously, but I do through the wonders of science. Yep. And, to think I started with this amazing life and came so close to giving nothing back to the world. Nothing. And yet the third part of my life, I truly believe everybody could have what I have. And by that, I don't mean fancy cars. So I haven't really talked about this last part, and I don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time delving into it. But essentially, I had this crazy notion, what if I just invent stuff and give it away? So every year, I make an ungodly amount of money, not IPO industrialist money, but I make a huge amount. And every year, we give it all away. We keep enough to pay our rent, and we live off of what my wife earns running research for the San Francisco school system. I have decided that I should lean into my own research. That says, you know, if I really wanted to distill it down, I've had the chance to literally analyze billions of data points on this issue of what predicts the best life outcomes. Purpose is not the only way to think about it. It is one of many factors, but it is a dominant and prominent one. What all of those data points distill down to is if you want an amazing life, you have to give it to someone else. That has multiple meanings, right? It means literally, in some sense, giving your life. Maybe it's a stranger that you've never met before, but you have to be willing to make a sacrifice. But it also has another meaning, which is you have to actually give an amazing life to someone else. The simple truth is, I think about what I've been able to do. One of the first AIs to treat diabetes, algorithms to reduce bias in hiring, and economic models to measure the impact of entrepreneurs in real time, so you can actually local communities can change programs. I built systems for bipolar disorder and for Alzheimer's and traumatic brain injury. I've had the chance to work on so many different amazing projects, and none of them should have happened. You know, if you'd laid odds when I was 20-year-old, your overwhelming bet would have been I'd be dead by the end of the 90s. And sure enough, you know, it's hard to imagine that 19 times out of 20, rerun the universe, I pull that trigger. And I had unbelievable advantages compared to everyone else. How about all of those kids that grew up in a world, whatever that is, a favela in Rio, a village outside Kinshasa, down the street from me here in Berkeley? They don't get 1,000 chances like I did. They don't get 3. In fact, what's really clear from the research on high stress childhoods and social isolation is they didn't even get 1. The person that they were born as gets taken away from day one. It doesn't mean, of course, someone like that can't achieve and do something amazing, but you stack the deck against them. So for me, I look at the life I lead and I think this should be everyone. Not literally the choices I make, just that opportunity to do something amazing. I truly believe, while everyone is different and what they would give the world is different, that's what's beautiful about it, that they should have that chance. And my life is testament to that. So in that sense, I don't want it to require 3 brain cancers or this kind of miserable middle section to your life that I had, or any of these other stories. Of course, those are catalysts. People are right. That is exactly what that is a catalyst. If you come out the other end. But what if my family hadn't stuck with me all those years? I'd still be on the street. What if I pulled the trigger? I'd be dead. What if I had accepted, you know, that all I'd ever do is run a bookstore? That would have been a nice life. And all the people that are alive because of the algorithm we developed for diabetes would be dead. Well, if I could do that, how much more would this world have? In every sense, I don't just mean economically. If everyone had those same chances, and how do you get there that doesn't require those brutal experiences? So I fundamentally believe that that's achievable. And one of the challenges is it requires an immense amount of courage. Like the, you know, even the a metaphor I often use. So I the story about sacrifice being a predictor of or correlate of purpose, and purpose being a strong predictor of positive life outcomes. And I mean, across the board, wealth and income, walking speed at age 65, social connectivity, happiness, insulin sensitivity, central morbidity, central body mass, like all of these measures, everything you'd want to be when you're 65, people with a stronger sense of purpose are much more likely to have that. So, but this is this weird, now I've set up a bit of a paradox, right? If purpose is best measured by sacrifice, yet these people end up having a better life.
Yes.
It's like there's this grand race, and the people that win the race are the one that stop and help the other racers. It shouldn't work. Economic theory says it shouldn't work. Yes. At least traditional liberal economic theory says, yeah, don't be a complete and total asshole, but rational self-interest. Serve your own needs. Yeah. If they serve their own needs, everything will work out. And yet we see again and again at the level of individuals, at the level of companies.
Yeah.
Now I'm trying to understand it at the level of macroeconomic scale, but yes. Sacrifice. The more you measure sacrifice within an individual, within a community, the healthier it is, the better its outcomes. And leaning into that, but to believe that, to be willing to make a sacrifice, to be willing to be good to someone else, even though you stand to gain nothing from it, takes courage. Yeah. It takes effort. And let me be clear, even in this life, I failed. One of the projects I am most proud of in my life, mm-hmm. So I worked on that CIA project over 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's one something valuable. I learned how to do facial analysis using machine learning. And I've had a couple of different projects. One for autistic kids, we built a system for Google Glass to read facial expressions so that they could learn how to read facial expressions in natural interactions. Mm-hmm. That was a wonderful project. But I also did this thing. Oh my goodness, it's a whole story unto itself. So I'm just going to tell you, we built the system to reunite orphan refugees with their extended family members. I was during the time of my very first startup, and we couldn't pay our rent. The startup, no one wanted to invest in some crazy woman's notion of how AI ought to be used in education. But I was working on this project. We built this whole system for a UN project called Refugees United to reunite orphan refugees. And we built a system, and then I chickened out. And I thought, I want to do this, but if I don't make progress on our actual business, the business will go away, and I'll have nothing. And so we called up Ericsson, who were the corporate sponsors, and the UN, and we said, we're so sorry, but we just can't keep working on this completely for free. And that's what this project is. We're terribly sorry. And now I look back on it and I think people died. I cared more about my startup than whether these little kids were able to find their families. Mm. We went back. It was even just like 8 months later. I just thought, this is crazy. And I rebuilt the whole system, trained it up, and we went back to them, but it was too late. And they'd already moved on. And I am as proud of that project as I've ever been of anything.
Yeah.
As proud of that as I am of the AI I built to treat my own son's diabetes.
Yeah.
And yet I also recognize what a profound failure it was because I lost the courage to be willing to make a sacrifice. I'm sympathetic to myself. It was a big sacrifice, but I should have done it anyways. And recently I was asked to give a talk, crazily enough, to 30,000 people. I guess it wasn't that recently. You don't get 30,000 people in one room anymore. But I got to give a keynote for the Grace Hopper Conference, which is the largest women in technology conference in the world. And they asked me to talk about courage. And I thought, I don't have any research about courage. None of my projects or my academic research is specifically about that. But I thought about what I did research, which is purpose, and also what I knew about failing and succeeding. And I realized that courage, it isn't something you just are. You aren't just courageous. Sure, people are different and our genes are different and so forth. But courage is something you practice and you have to practice hard. And you start small and you get better and better. Because when that moment comes, choose between your company or some kids you're never, ever going to meet. Choose between being worth $100 billion or having a good little company that doesn't secretly steal everybody's data. I'm not talking about anyone in particular. what happens when you have those moments that require courage and you haven't been practicing? You weren't ready for when it was actually hard, when what the world needed and what you want right in the moment really diverge. That is courage. And I guess what I'm hoping is that my work, for example, in global education, has the impact not of teaching a kid to factorize a polynomial or know, you know, when the Treaty of Westphalia was signed, but instead it's something deeper. How do you build into a kid a sense of purpose? Yeah. How do you build into them resilience? How do you let their creativity flourish? Where do you give them the fundamentals, that very basic sort of cognitive neurological features like working memory and attention are able to flourish? Everybody's different. Everybody yeah. has strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. But I truly believe that you lay those foundations early in people's lives in any number of different ways, but there's nothing like a role model.
Yeah,
then for sure. You have the chance to maybe give them this amazing thing, which is a shot, not at a better life, but a shot for they themselves to give someone else a better life.
Yeah. And that's really what it is.
And that's amazing.
Yeah. So that is changing the world. If you can just help your kids to identify with the kids that are sitting alone in the playground, to plant their own vegetables, to make their own compost, to, you know, those little tiny little things. How to robot proof your kids, all about humanity, right? We're going to need to bring this to a close. I just see so many things, but there are three very quick things I'm going to ask you, and they're going to be quick answers, I know. So number one, Vivian, how do you pronounce the second name in the middle?
Lecure.
Lecure Ming.
Yes.
Where did that come from?
Vivian Lecure Ming. So I have, again, ancestors from all across Europe. But when I changed myself,
yes,
I changed my name.
Yeah.
My wife actually said to me, you know, I wanted to name my first daughter Vivian.
Yes.
Would you use that name?
Uh-huh.
So she gave me the name, but we gave it the Frenchified spelling because the Lecures left France in the 1600s and came to Quebec and then down in, and that's where my mother's line comes from.
Yeah.
So Vivian Lecure, and then Ming is a smash up of Smith and Chang. If you combine those names together, you get a variety of alien invaders, Sming, Smang, Chith, Chaff. So we took Sming, we dropped the S, succeeded in making both sides of the family unhappy, which is the heart of compromise.
Okay, then another quick one. Who carried the babies?
So Norma, the day will come when someone like me gets to carry a child. In fact, working on womb transplants is something that is actively happening.
Sure.
So I am, we plan this with immense precision. I did my son the good old fashioned way.
Yeah.
I figured I'm going to do one good thing with this old body that I didn't want. And I am the donor for my daughter, and yes, my wife had to go through all of that. But I have to say, when my son was just born, I was walking out of a market holding my little infant child in my hands, and someone looked at him and looked at me and said, "Wow, you look amazing." And I said, "Yeah, it turns out it isn't that hard." So it's my other favorite one is my wife and I were walking together out of the same market actually with my son. And so someone was taking signatures out front, which happens a lot in Berkeley. And she looks at him and said, "Oh, he's so cute. And he looks just like, how did you do that?" So wonders of modern science.
Yeah, well.
She did all the heavy lifting, and and then I took my turn as a stay-at-home mom for a little bit since I was going through transition at the same time.
Yeah.
But it was
a good timing.
Turns out, even a lonely person like me isn't. It's hard. It is hard being at home with a little kid all by yourself, 24 hours a day. But I loved it. I love being a mom.
Stunning. Okay, I would absolutely love to chat more another time about purpose in the workplace and productivity and profitability and coming out classes for everyone and, you know, authenticity and there's so many things. But wow, just what a treat, what an absolute privilege for me, for those listening. Thank you so much for being so vulnerable, so real, so authentic, just so much of who you are, and you are amazing. You really are amazing. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I believe in what I do. I may think I personally am a bit of a ridiculous character, but I believe in what I do, and I'm thrilled with the chance to be able to share some of it.
Thank you. thank you for staying right to the end of the episode and for joining me on the Enrichment Project. Before you go, please share this episode with your friends and your colleagues. They will thank you, I'm sure. Remember that you can catch each Path to Purpose episode by watching on YouTube or, if you prefer, on your favorite podcast app. The link to my book, The Power of Purpose, is in the show notes. Please go and check it out. It's a rad account of my own story of purpose and resilience and my fight against brain cancer. I finished 6 full Ironman events, a number of multi-stage mountain bike races, 9 Ironman 70.3 races, including the Ironman World Championships, and a bunch of other endurance events, all with stage 4 brain cancer, because I wanted it that badly and getting to the finish line meant that much to me. As a professional inspirational speaker, business and life coach, author and storyteller, I'd love to add more value to you or your organization. Please find more details on my website, iamrichardwright.com, and book me today for a live or virtual keynote, a masterclass, workshop or coaching session, or please follow my journey on Facebook, I Am Richard Wright, Twitter, The Wright Rich, Instagram, I Am Richard Wright, or on LinkedIn. I'd love the opportunity to enrich your team. Thank you to the professional crew at Solid Gold Podcasts for the support, the talent, and the mad skills. And to Anna Hick for her creativity and genius video magic, thank you. You all rock.